12. The bourgeoisie prepares to restore slavery. Toussaint was perfectly right in his suspicions. What is the regime under which the colonies have most prospered? Asked Bonaparte. And on being told the Ancien Régime, he decided to restore it, slavery and mulatto discrimination. Bonaparte hated black people. The revolution had appointed that brave and brilliant mulatto, General Dumas, commander-in-chief of one of its armies, but Bonaparte detested him for his color and persecuted him. Yet Bonaparte was no colonist, and his anti-Negro bias was far from influencing his major policies. He wanted profits for his supporters, and the clamorous colonists found in him a ready ear. The bourgeoisie of the maritime towns wanted the fabulous profits of the old days. The passionate desire to free all humanity, which had called for Negro freedom in the great days of the revolution, now huddled in the slums of Paris and Marseille, exhausted by its great efforts and terrorized by Bonaparte's bayonets and Fouché's police. But the abolition of slavery was one of the proudest memories of the revolution. And, much more important, the San Domingo blacks had an army and leaders trained to fight in the European manner. These were no savage tribesmen with spears, against whom European soldiers armed with rifles could win undying glory. Occupied with his European campaigns, Bonaparte never lost sight of San Domingo, as he never lost sight of anything. His officers presented plan after plan, but the British fleet and the unknown strength of the blacks prevented action. Yet early in March 1801, a shift in his policy nearly compelled him to leave Toussaint in complete charge of San Domingo. French and British bourgeoisie were in the middle of that struggle for world supremacy which lasted over 20 years and devastated Europe. Bonaparte aimed at India, and having missed his first spring by way of Egypt, he won over the Tsar Paul, and these two arranged to march overland and steal from the British what these had stolen from the Indians. Bonaparte could not fight in two hemispheres at once, and on March 4th, he wrote a letter to Toussaint. A letter beaming with goodwill. He had been busy, but now that peace was near, he had had time to read Toussaint's letters. He would appoint him Captain General of the island. He asked Toussaint to develop agriculture and build up the armed forces. The time, I hope, will not be far when a division from San Domingo will be able to contribute in your part of the world to the glory and the possessions of the Republic. But the British bourgeoisie, driven out of America, now fully realized the importance of India. Pitt, in collusion with Paul's son Alexander, organized the murder of the pro-French Paul. 7 days after the letter to Toussaint was written, Paul was strangled, and on the following day, the British fleet sailed into the Baltic. When Bonaparte heard, he knew at once that Pitt had beaten him. And the Indian raid was off. The letter and instructions to Toussaint were never sent, and Bonaparte prepared to destroy Toussaint. It is Toussaint's supreme merit that while he saw European civilization as a valuable and necessary thing, and strove to lay its foundations among his people, he never had the illusion that it conferred any moral superiority. He knew French, British, and Spanish imperialists for the insatiable gangsters that they were, that there is no oath too sacred for them to break, no crime, deception, treachery, cruelty, destruction of human life and property which they would not commit against those who could not defend themselves. When Vincent arrived in Paris, preparations were well underway, but the Constitution gave Bonaparte a convenient excuse. Poor Vincent had attempted to persuade Toussaint to give way to Bonaparte by condemning the Constitution as treason. Now he tried to persuade Bonaparte to give way to Toussaint by denying that the Constitution was treason. Bonaparte accused Toussaint of being sold to the British. Stoutly, Vincent defended him. Bonaparte swore at Vincent, cursed the gilded Africans, said that he would not leave an epaulet on the shoulders of a single nigger in the colony. Vincent put it to him that Britain might assist Toussaint. Bonaparte boasted that Britain had shown some inclination to oppose the expedition, but when he threatened to clothe Toussaint with unlimited powers and acknowledge his independence, the British had kept silent. Bonaparte thought that they dreaded the effect of an independent San Domingo on their own slave colony of Jamaica. But Pitt, Dundas, and Maitland were laughing in their sleeves and rubbing their hands in anticipation. Vincent tried to point out the dangers of the expedition. Bonaparte called Toussaint a revolted slave, called Vincent a coward, and drove him from his presence. Vincent was appalled at Bonaparte's violence. If this was the spirit in which the French were going to San Domingo, they were heading for a fall. As anxious now for France as for San Domingo, he took the bold step of addressing a memoir to the minister, in which he tried to paint the strength of the colony and the extraordinary genius of the man who ruled there. At the head of so many resources is a man the most active and tireless of whom one can possibly have any idea. It is the strictest truth to say that he is everywhere, and above all, in that spot where a sound judgment and danger make it essential for him to be. His great sobriety, the faculty accorded to him alone of never taking a rest, the advantage he enjoys of being able to start at once with the work in his office after wearisome journeys, of replying to 100 letters a day and tiring out his secretaries. More than that, the art of tantalizing and confusing everybody, even to deceit. All this makes of him a man so superior to all around him that respect and submission reach the limits of fanaticism in a vast number of heads. He has imposed on his brothers in San Domingo a power without bounds. He is the absolute master of the island, and nothing can counteract his wishes, whatever they may be. Although some distinguished men, but very few blacks among them, know what are his plans, and view them with great fear. Vincent described Toussaint as superior to everyone in San Domingo. But if one reads that extract again, it becomes clear that this brave, honest, intelligent, and experienced officer was obviously describing the most extraordinary human being he had ever met in his life, with powers beyond what he thought possible. In the writings of contemporaries describing the great figures of the French Revolution and Napoleonic era, one finds this note of astonishment, this "I can't believe my own eyes" attitude in writings about only three men: Bonaparte, Nelson the sailor, and Toussaint. Bonaparte was so angry that he banished Vincent to the island of Elba. Personally loved and respected by all their contemporaries, Vincent and Beauvais failed, as will fail all who do not understand that in a revolution, each must choose his side and stick to it. But though Bonaparte might shout "nigger" in the best slave-owning manner, more than anyone in France he divined the difficulties. At first, he had thought it easy. The colonists who had fled in the early days of the revolution thought of the slaves as a motley crowd of black brigands who would fly at the first sight of white men. How could such cowed and trembling niggers ever be anything else? They had defeated the British? Nonsense. That was fever. General Michel of the last commission, who had not seen Toussaint's armies in action, called his officers a collection of conceited incompetents. But Room, Pascal, and Vincent, all of whom liked the blacks and therefore knew what they were capable of, were against any expedition. Pascal said that the more enlightened of the blacks, that is, those who had been free before the revolution, did not love Toussaint. But 49/50 of the population followed him blindly, regarding him as being inspired by God. Room's attitude was most astonishing. Room was not even a Frenchman, but a Creole from Tobago. Yet, despite his rough treatment at the hands of Toussaint, he still retained his belief in Toussaint's devotion to France. He wrote that Toussaint had acted irregularly because of his fear of slavery. Let Bonaparte clothe him with full civil and military power and reassure him about the future. At the end of the war, he would hand back the colony. Malenfant, an old colonist who was now an official in San Domingo, was offered a post in the expedition. He drafted a memorandum full of praise for Toussaint and the laborers and warned Bonaparte against the catastrophe he was preparing. When he met Leclerc, the captain general, a few days before the fleet sailed, Leclerc accused him of cowardice. "All the niggers, when they see an army, will lay down their arms. They will be only too happy that we pardon them."
"You are misinformed, General."
"But there is a colonist who has offered to arrest Toussaint in the interior of the country with 60 grenadiers."
"He is bolder than I, for I would not attempt it with 60,000.
"He is very rich, Toussaint. He has more than 40 millions."
Patiently, Malenfant pointed out to him that it was impossible for Toussaint to have this sum. Malenfant shared Roume's opinion of Toussaint. He said afterwards that if Bonaparte had sent Lavaux to San Domingo with 3,000 men, all would have been well. Toussaint was an eminently reasonable man, and he and Lavaux would have worked out a modus vivendi, whereby French capital would have had full opportunity in the island. It was not to be. Leclerc pooh-poohed Malenfant's remonstrances and dismissed him. Bonaparte never had any such foolish ideas. Vincent had told him of the strength of Toussaint's army, with its soldiers and officers tried and experienced by 10 years of constant fighting, and the great soldier added more and more men to the force. So as to avoid too much talk, he distributed his preparations in every harbor in France, Holland, and Belgium. The preliminaries of peace were signed on October 1, 1801. 8 days after, Bonaparte gave the word, and even the delay of adverse winds held up the expedition only until December 14th. It was the largest expedition that had ever sailed from France, consisting of 20,000 veteran troops, under some of Bonaparte's ablest officers. The chief of staff was Duguay, whom Bonaparte had left in charge of Egypt when he set out on the march to Palestine. Boudet had commanded the advance guard of Desiques, whose last-minute attack had saved Bonaparte from a disastrous defeat at Marengo. Boyer had commanded the mobile guards which patrolled Upper Egypt. Humbert had commanded the expedition against Ireland. There were men who had experience of guerrilla warfare in La Vendée. General Pamphile de Lacroix, who sailed with the expedition and wrote a valuable history of the campaign and the San Domingo Revolution, has left us his opinion. The army of Leclerc was composed of an infinite number of soldiers with great talent, good strategists, great tacticians, officers of engineers and artillery, well-educated and very resourceful. At the last moment, Bonaparte changed the command, putting his brother-in-law, Leclerc, at the head, a sign of the importance he attached to the venture. Pauline, Leclerc's wife, and their son went with the expedition. She carried musicians, artists, and all the paraphernalia of a court. Slavery would be reestablished, civilization restarted, and a good time would be had by all. And in these last crucial months, Toussaint, fully aware of Bonaparte's preparations, was busy sawing off the branch on which he sat. In the north, around Plaisance, Limbé, Dondon, the vanguard of the revolution was not satisfied with the new regime. Toussaint's discipline was hard, but it was infinitely better than the old slavery. What these old revolutionary blacks objected to was working for their white masters. Moïse was the commandant of the North Province, and Moïse sympathized with the blacks. Work, yes, but not for whites. "Whatever my old uncle may do, I cannot bring myself to be the executioner of my color. It is always in the interests of the metropolis that he scolds me. But these interests are those of the whites, and I shall only love them when they have given me back the eye that they made me lose in battle."
Gone were the days when Toussaint would leave the front and ride through the night to inquire into the grievances of the laborers, and though protecting the whites, make the laborers see that he was their leader. Revolutionaries through and through, those bold men, own brothers of the Cordeliers in Paris and the Viborg workers in Petrograd, organized another insurrection. Their aim was to massacre the whites, overthrow Toussaint's government, and, some hoped, put Moïse in his place. Every observer, and Toussaint himself, thought that the laborers were following him because of his past services and his unquestioned superiority. This insurrection proved that they were following him because he represented that complete emancipation from their former degradation, which was their chief goal. As soon as they saw that he was no longer going to this end, they were ready to throw him over. This was no mere riot of a few discontented or lazy blacks. It was widespread over the North. The revolutionaries chose a time when Toussaint was away at Petite Rivière, attending the wedding of Dessalines. The movement should have begun in Le Cap on September 21st, but Christophe heard of it just in time to check the first outbursts in various quarters of the town. On the 22nd and 23rd, the revolt burst in the revolutionary districts of Marmelade, Plaisance, Limbé, Port Margot, and Dondon, home of the famous regiment of the Sans-Culottes. On the morning of the 23rd, it broke out again in Le Cap, while armed bands, killing all the whites whom they met on the way, appeared in the suburbs to make contact with those in the town. While Christophe defeated these, Toussaint and Dessalines marched against the rising in Marmelade and Dondon, and it fell to pieces before him and his terrible lieutenant. Moïse, avoiding a meeting with Toussaint, attacked and defeated another band. But blacks in certain districts had revolted to the cry of, "Long live Moïse!" Toussaint therefore had him arrested, and would not allow the military tribunal even to hear him. The documents, he said, were enough. "I flatter myself that the commissioners will not delay a judgment so necessary to the tranquility of the colony." He was afraid that Moïse might supplant him. Upon this hint, the commission gave judgment, and Moïse was shot. He died as he had lived. He stood before the place of execution in the presence of the troops of the garrison, and in a firm voice gave the word to the firing squad. "Fire, my friends. Fire." What exactly did Moïse stand for? We shall never know. 40 years after his death, Majou, the Haitian historian, gave an outline of Moïse's program, whose authenticity, however, has been questioned. Toussaint refused to break up the large estates. Moïse wanted small grants of land for junior officers and even the rank and file. Toussaint favored the whites against the mulattoes. Moïse sought to build an alliance between the blacks and the mulattoes against the French. It is certain that he had a strong sympathy for the laborers and hated the old slave owners. But he was not anti-white. He bitterly regretted the indignities to which he had been forced to submit room, and we know how highly he esteemed Sontenac's. We have very little to go on, but he seems to have been a singularly attractive and possibly profound person. The old slave owners hated him, and they pressed Toussaint to get rid of him. Christophe, too, was jealous of Moïse, and Christophe loved white society. Guilty or not guilty of treason, Moïse had too many enemies to escape the implications of the "Long live Moïse!" shouted by the revolutionaries. To the blacks of the North, already angry at Toussaint's policy, the execution of Moïse was the final disillusionment. They could not understand it. As was, and is, inevitable, they thought in terms of color. After Toussaint himself, Moïse, his nephew, symbolized the revolution. He it was who had led the laborers against Edouville. He also had led the insurrection which extorted the authority from Rome to take over Spanish San Domingo, an insurrection which to the laborers had been for the purpose of stopping the Spanish traffic in slaves. Moïse had arrested Rome and later Vincent, and now Toussaint had shot him. for taking the part of the blacks against the whites. Toussaint recognized his error. If the break with the French and Vincent had shaken him from his usual calm in their last interview, it was nothing to the remorse which moved him after the execution of Moise. None who knew him had ever seen him so agitated. He tried to explain it away in a long proclamation. Moise was the soul of the insurrection. Moise was a young man of loose habits. It was useless. Moise had stood too high in his councils for too long. But so set was Toussaint that he could only think of further repression. Why should the blacks support Moise against him? That question he did not stop to ask, or if he did, failed to appreciate the answer. In the districts of the insurrection, he shot without mercy. He lined up the laborers and spoke to them in turn, and on the basis of a stumbling answer or uncertainty, decided who should be shot. Cowed by his power, they submitted. He published a series of laws surpassing in severity anything he had yet decreed. He introduced a rigid passport system for all classes of the population. He confined the laborers to their plantations more strictly than ever, and he made the managers and foremen responsible for this law under pain of imprisonment. Anyone fomenting disorder could be condemned to 6 months' hard labor, with a weight attached to his foot by a chain. He prohibited the soldiers from visiting a plantation except to see their fathers or mothers, and then only for a limited period. He was now afraid of the contact between the revolutionary army and the people, an infallible sign of revolutionary degeneration. And while he broke the morale of the black masses, he labored to reassure the whites. Some of them rejoiced openly at the rumors of the expedition, and Toussaint, instead of treating them as he had treated the laborers, merely deported them. There were others, we need not doubt, who, holding the same views, thought it wiser to keep their mouths shut. A substantial number, however, accepted the new order and viewed with dismay the violence and destruction which they knew were inevitable if a French expedition came. Some began to leave and asked for passports. One of the most notable Creoles in San Domingo, a man of good education and judgment, who fully accepted the new San Domingo, came to Toussaint and asked him for a passport. Here was what Toussaint dreaded: the breakup of the unstable regime before it had had a chance to acquire cohesion. He went quickly to the door to see that he was not likely to be overheard, a characteristic action. Then coming back, he looked de Nogeret full in the face and asked him, "Why do you want to go away, you whom I esteem and love?" "Because I am white, and notwithstanding the kindly feelings you have for me, I see that you are about to become the irritated chief of the blacks." With some injustice, he accused Toussaint of deporting those whites who had rejoiced at the coming of the expedition. Toussaint justified his action with warmth. "They have had the imprudence and folly to rejoice at such news, as if the expedition was not destined to destroy me, to destroy the whites, to destroy the colony." With a mind such as his, essentially creative and orderly, this was the prospect which preoccupied him and warped his judgment. "In France, I am represented as an independent power, and therefore they are arming against me. Against me, who refused General Maitland's offer to establish my independence under the protection of England, and who always rejected the proposals which Sontenac's made to me on the subject." He knew that the expedition was on its way, but still he hoped that somehow the coming catastrophe might be averted. "Since, however, you wish to set out for France, I consent. But at least let your voyage be useful to the colony. I will send letters to the First Consul by you, and I will entreat him to listen to you. Tell him about me. Tell him how prosperous agriculture is, how prosperous is commerce. In a word, tell him what I have done. It is according to all I have done here that I ought and that I wish to be judged."
20 times I have written to Bonaparte to ask him to send civil commissioners, to tell him to dispatch hither the old colonists, whites instructed in administering public affairs, good machinists, good workmen. He never replied. Suddenly he avails himself of the peace of which he has not deigned to inform me and of which I learn only through the English, in order to direct against me a formidable expedition, in the ranks of which I see my personal enemies and people injurious to the colony whom I sent away. Come to me within 24 hours. How I want you and my letters to arrive in time to make the First Consul change his determination, to make him see that in ruining me, he ruins the blacks, ruins not only San Domingo, but all the Western colonies. If Bonaparte is the first man in France, Toussaint is the first man in the archipelago of the Antilles. He had no false modesty as to what he meant to San Domingo. He reflected for a moment, then said in a firm tone that he had been making arrangements with the English to get 20,000 blacks from Africa, but not for treachery, to make them soldiers of France. I know the perfidy of the English. I am under no obligation to them for the information they gave me as to the expedition coming to San Domingo. No, never will I arm for them. But reality forced itself on him again. I took up arms for the freedom of my color, which France alone proclaimed, but which she has no right to nullify. Our liberty is no longer in her hands. It is in our own. We will defend it or perish. This strange duality, so confusing to his people who had to do the fighting, continued to the very end. And yet, in this moment of his greatest uncertainty, so different from his usual clarity of mind and vigor of action, Toussaint showed himself one of those few men for whom power is a means to an end, the development of civilization, the betterment of his fellow creatures. His very hesitations were a sign of the superior cast of his mind. Dessalines and Moïse would not have hesitated. He issued another proclamation, and devoted most of it to reassuring the white proprietors, who will always find in us ardent protectors, true friends, zealous defenders. What did all this mean to the former slaves? When he touched the expedition, the confusion of his mind was evident in every line. Men of good faith will not be able any longer to believe that France, who abandoned San Domingo to herself at a time when her enemies disputed possession, will now send there an army to destroy the men who have not ceased to serve her will. After thus sowing doubt in the minds of the people as to the intentions of the French, he continued, "But if it so happens that this crime of which the French government is suspected is real, it suffices for me to say that a child who knows the rights that nature has given over it to the author of its days shows itself obedient and submissive toward its father and mother. And if, in spite of its submission and obedience, the father and mother are unnatural enough to wish to destroy it, there remains no other course than to place its vengeance in the hands of God." So God was to defend the blacks from slavery. What of the army and the people and himself, their leader? "Brave soldiers, generals, officers, and rank and file, do not listen to the wicked. I shall show you the road you ought to follow. I am a soldier. I am afraid of no man, and I fear only God. If I must die, it shall be as a soldier of honor with no fear of reproach." Toussaint could not believe that the French ruling class would be so depraved, so lost to all sense of decency, as to try to restore slavery. His grasp of politics led him to make all preparations, but he could not admit to himself and to his people that it was easier to find decency, gratitude, justice, and humanity in a cage of starving tigers than in the councils of imperialism, whether in the cabinets of Pitt or Bonaparte, of Baldwin, Laval, or Blum. Criticism is not enough. What should Toussaint have done?
150 years of history and the scientific study of revolution begun by Marx and Engels and amplified by Lenin and Trotsky justify us in pointing to an alternative course. Lenin and the Bolsheviks, after the October Revolution, faced much the same problem as Toussaint. Russian bourgeois culture was a relatively poor thing, but Lenin admitted frankly that it was superior to that of the proletariat and would have to be used until the proletariat had developed itself. He rigidly excluded the bourgeoisie from political power, but he proposed that they should be given important posts and good salaries, higher than those of Communist Party members. Even some communists who had suffered and fought under Tsarism were after a time dismissed and replaced by competent bourgeois. We can measure Toussaint's gigantic intellect by the fact that, untrained as he was, he attempted to do the same, his black army and generals filling the political role of the Bolshevik Party. If he kept whites in his army, it was for the same reason that the Bolsheviks also kept Tsarist officers. Neither revolution had enough trained and educated officers of its own, and the black Jacobins, relatively speaking, were far worse off culturally than the Russian Bolsheviks. The whole theory of the Bolshevik policy was that the victories of the new regime would gradually win over those who had been constrained to accept it by force. Toussaint hoped for the same. If he failed, it is for the same reason that the Russian Socialist Revolution failed, even after all its achievements, the defeat of the revolution in Europe. Had the Jacobins been able to consolidate the Democratic Republic in 1794, Haiti would have remained a French colony, but an attempt to restore slavery would have been most unlikely. It was in method and not in principle that Toussaint failed. The race question is subsidiary to the class question in politics, and to think of imperialism in terms of race is disastrous, but to neglect the racial factor as merely incidental is an error only less grave than to make it fundamental. There were Jacobin workmen in Paris who would have fought for the blacks against Bonaparte's troops. But the international movement was not then what it is today, and there were none in San Domingo. The black laborers saw only the old slave-owning whites. These would accept the new regime, but never to the extent of fighting for it against a French army. And the masses knew this. Toussaint, of course, knew this also. He never trusted Agier, his chief of staff, who was a Frenchman, and asked Agier's junior, Lamartinière, to keep an eye on him. But whereas Lenin kept the party and the masses thoroughly aware of every step, and explained carefully the exact position of the bourgeois servants of the worker state, Toussaint explained nothing and allowed the masses to think that their old enemies were being favored at their expense. In allowing himself to be looked upon as taking the side of the whites against the blacks, Toussaint committed the unpardonable crime in the eyes of a community where the whites stood for so much evil. That they should get back their property was bad enough. That they should be privileged was intolerable. And to shoot Moïse, the black, for the sake of the whites was more than an error. It was a crime. It was almost as if Lenin had had Trotsky shot for taking the side of the proletariat against the bourgeoisie. Toussaint's position was extraordinarily difficult. San Domingo was, after all, a French colony. Granted that before the expedition was a certainty, plain speech was impossible. Once he understood that it was coming, there should have been no hesitation. He should have declared that a powerful expedition could have no other aim than the restoration of slavery, summoned the population to resist, declared independence, confiscated the property of all who refused to accept, and distributed it among his supporters. Agier and the other white officers should have been given a plain choice. Accept or leave. If they had accepted, intending to be traitors, the black officers would have been on guard against them. The men would have known where they stood and would have shot them at the slightest vacillation before the enemy. The whites should have been offered the same choice. Accept the black regime, which has guaranteed and will guarantee your property, or leave. Traitors in wartime would be dealt with as all traitors in war. Many of the planters favored independence. They would have stayed and contributed their knowledge, such as it was, to the new state. Not only former slaves had followed Toussaint. La Martinière was a mulatto so white that only those who knew his origins could tell that he had Negro ancestry, but he was absolutely and completely devoted to the cause of Toussaint. So was Maurepas, an old free black. With Dessalines, Belair, Moïse, and the hundreds of other officers, ex-slave and formerly free, it would have been easy for Toussaint to get the mass of the population behind him. Having the army, some of the better educated blacks and mulattoes, and the laborers who had supported him so staunchly in everything, he would have been invincible. With the issue unobscure and his power clear, many who might otherwise have hesitated would have come down on the side that was taking decisive action. With a decisive victory won, it was not impossible to reopen negotiations with a chastened French government to establish the hoped-for relations. It was the ex-slave laborers and the ex-slave army which would decide the issue, and Toussaint's policy crippled both. He left the army with a divided allegiance. There were Frenchmen in it whose duty would be to fight for France. They, the mulattoes, and the old free blacks had no fears about their liberty. Instead of bringing the black laborers nearer, he drove them away from him. Even after the revolt, it was not too late. Lenin crushed the Kronstadt revolt with a relentless hand, but in a manner so abrupt as to call forth protests from sticklers for party discipline, he proposed the new economic policy immediately afterwards. It was this quick recognition of danger that saved the Russian Revolution. Toussaint crushed the revolt, as he was bound to do. But instead of recognizing the origin of the revolt as springing from the fear of the same enemy that he was arming against, he was sterner with the revolutionaries than he had ever been before. It happened that the day on which Moïse was executed, November 21st, was the very day fixed by Bonaparte for the departure of the expedition. Instead of reprisals, Toussaint should have covered the country, and in the homely way that he understood so well, mobilized the masses, talked to the people, explained the situation to them, and told them what he wanted them to do. As it was, the policy he persisted in reduced the masses to a state of stupor. It has been said that he was thinking of the effect in France. His severity and his proclamation reassuring the whites aimed at showing Bonaparte that all classes were safe in San Domingo, and that he could be trusted to govern the colony with justice. It is probably true, and is his greatest condemnation. Bonaparte was not going to be convinced by Toussaint's justice and fairness and capacity to govern. Where imperialists do not find disorder, they create it deliberately, as Edouville did. They want an excuse for going in. But they can find that easily, and will go in even without any. It is force that counts, and chiefly the organized force of the masses. Always, but particularly at the moment of struggle, a leader must think of his own masses. It is what they think that matters, not what the imperialists think. And if to make matters clear to them, Toussaint had to condone a massacre of the whites, so much the worse for the whites. He had done everything possible for them. And if the race question occupied the place that it did in San Domingo, it was not the fault of the blacks. But Toussaint, like Robespierre, destroyed his own left wing, and with it, sealed his own doom. The tragedy was that there was no need for it. Robespierre struck at the masses because he was bourgeois and they were communist. That clash was inevitable, and regrets over it are vain. But between Toussaint and his people, there was no fundamental difference of outlook or of aim. Knowing the race question for the political and social question that it was, he tried to deal with it in a purely political and social way. It was a grave error. Lenin, in his thesis to the Second Congress of the Communist International, warned the white revolutionaries, a warning they badly need, that such has been the effect of the policy of imperialism on the relationship between advanced and backward peoples, that European communists will have to make wide concessions to natives of colonial countries in order to overcome the justified prejudice which these feel toward all classes in the oppressing countries. Toussaint, as his power grew, forgot that. He ignored the black laborers, bewildered them at the very moment that he needed them most. And to bewilder the masses is to strike the deadliest of all blows at the revolution. His personal weakness, the obverse side of his strength, played its part also. He left even his generals in the dark. A naturally silent and reserved man, he had been formed by military discipline. He gave orders and expected them to be obeyed. Nobody ever knew what he was doing. He said suddenly that Sontenac must go, and invited his generals to sign the letter or not as they pleased. When Vincent spoke to Christophe and Moise about the Constitution, they knew nothing about it. Moise's bitter complaint about Toussaint and the whites came obviously from a man to whom Toussaint had never explained the motives of his policy. They would not have needed much persuasion to follow a bold lead. Moise was feeling his way towards it, and we can point out Toussaint's weakness all the more clearly because Dessalines had actually found the correct method. His speech to the army was famous, and another version, he probably made it more than once, ran this way. If France wishes to try any nonsense here, everybody must rise together, men and women. Loud acclamations greeted this bold pronouncement, worth 1,000 of Toussaint's equivocal proclamations reassuring the whites. Dessalines had not the slightest desire to reassure whites. The whites were whites of the old regime. Dessalines did not care what they said or thought. The black laborers had to do the fighting, and it was they who needed reassurance. It was not that Toussaint had any illusions about the whites. He had none whatever. When the war had actually begun, he sent a curt message to his commanders. Leave nothing white behind you. But the mischief had been done. Yet Toussaint's error sprang from the very qualities that made him what he was. It is easy to see today, as his generals saw after he was dead, where he had erred. It does not mean that they or any of us would have done better in his place. If Dessalines could see so clearly and simply, it was because the ties that bound this uneducated soldier to French civilization were of the slenderest. He saw what was under his nose so well because he saw no further. Toussaint's failure was the failure of enlightenment, not of darkness. In the last days of December, the fleet of Admiral Villaret Joyeuse, bearing on board the first detachment of 12,000 men, sailed into the harbor of Samana Bay. Toussaint, standing alone on a neighboring peak, watched the vessels. Unaccustomed to naval armaments, he was overwhelmed by their number. As he returned to his staff, he uttered the words, "We shall perish. All France is come to overwhelm us." It was not fear. He was never afraid. But certain traits of character run deep in great men. Despite all that he had done, he was, at bottom, the same Toussaint who had hesitated to join the revolution in 1791 and for one whole month had protected his master's plantation from destruction. Only this time it was not a plantation and a few score slaves, but a colony and hundreds of thousands of people.